And Gary David, our special guest, get up to our website, coasttocoastam.com. Take a look at some of the pictures that Gary supplied us. We'll be back. Let's talk about the lost city in the Grand Canyon next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Gary David with us. Gary, the lost city. Tell me a little bit about it. Where is it? What is it?
Okay, before we get into that, because it's kind of a long story, I just want to direct the listeners to the graphics I have. I have seven pictures that they can see what I was talking about, the Arizona-Orion correlation, because you really need to see visually how the, you know, the constellation matches up with the pattern of villages that the Hopi have constructed over a period of about 2.5 centuries from 1050 AD to 1350 AD. And it's really uncanny, the correlation between the two, you know. And it's sort of like the Orion correlation in Egypt. And there's a lot of different Egyptian connections, which we'll see about when I talk about the lost city. But the fourth graphic down, if you look at the fourth graphic down, you can see Orion reaches toward the Grand Canyon. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The left arm of Orion reaches over and rests in the Grand Canyon, and it rests at a point that Pi 3 Orion is a star in the middle of the shield, or it could be a bow. And it corresponds to Osiris Temple. Now, there are a lot of different Egyptian names in Grand Canyon. There's Set Temple and Horus Temple and Osiris Temple and Isis Temple. So this is pointing to a very specific star in Orion, in the constellation Orion. This Pi 3 Orionis is kind of a special star. It's only 26 light years away. Some of the belt stars, for instance, are 1,500 light years away. And it has interested SETI. SETI is targeting this particular star. It's in the SETI star catalog. And this particular star is also among Project Phoenix's best and brightest candidates for having exoplanets and ET life. And it's among the top 10 target stars for the Terrestrial Planet Finder, which unfortunately it was a telescope that was set to be launched this year, but was canceled due to lack of funding. But it's my belief that star ancestors of the Hopi came from this particular star. And the god Masao wanted to honor these star ancestors by putting this right in the Grand Canyon, which is the most sacred spot for the Hopi. There's the star next to it. It's called the Sipapuni. It's Pi 5 Orionis. Mm-hmm. The Sipapuni is an interesting geological feature. You can see it right on Google Earth. It's on the north side of the Little Colorado River before it joins the main Colorado River. It's in the Grand Canyon. And this is the most sacred spot of the Hopi people. The Hopi actually came up from the third world into the fourth world and populated the Colorado Plateau from this. And you look at it, there's a picture, you can see it. There's the turquoise river flowing right by it. And it is a travertine or limestone dome made by Mineral Waters, and it looks like a circumpunct that the symbol that Dan Brown used in his book The Lost Symbol. This very sacred symbol that represents gold and the sun and the spark of divine consciousness. You know, this is an actual place that the Hopi make pilgrimages to. The Hopi have made salt pilgrimages. They gather sacred salt in this area. This is such a sacred area for the Hopi, and it corresponds to this one star, Pi 5 Orionis, which is also an interesting star in its own right.
Okay, now let's get into The Lost City.
Sure. The Lost City, as I said, you know, is a very interesting story, and the bare bones, so to speak, involve an article published on April 5th, 1909 in the Arizona Gazette.
It's a long time ago, isn't it?
Yeah, quite a while ago. It was Phoenix's daily, Phoenix, Arizona's daily newspaper, and they published a front page article. It was 2,200 words long, and it was a story about a man named G.E. Kincaid, and he was from Idaho, and he was working for the Smithsonian Institution. And he left Green River, Wyoming, in a wooden boat and sailed downstream, down the Colorado River. And he started out in October of 1908. And he sailed into the Grand Canyon. And in an area of the Grand Canyon called Marble Canyon, and this is just north of where the Little Colorado River flows into the main Colorado River, he spotted a cave entrance. High up on the cliff. It was like 2,000 feet above the river, and it was like 1,500 feet down from the rim of Grand Canyon. And he said he made it up this to this cave with great difficulty, and I think that was probably an understatement, because you look at the area now, the terrain now, it's such a difficult terrain to maneuver in. But he apparently made it to this cave entrance, and there was a symmetrical tunnel. It was like a square hole in the wall, and it was 12 feet wide, and the tunnel, there was a tunnel that extended horizontally into the side of the cliff. And you know what he found, George, was just amazing. These artifacts that he found in this tunnel are just mind-blowing. The tunnel went about 60 feet straight into the side of the cliff, and then there were two passageways that branched off on each side, and there were a number of rooms with, like he described, oval-shaped doors.
Did people live there at some time?
Well, amazingly enough, the article says that this complex could hold up to 50,000 people.
Well, it's like an underground city.
It is, yeah. And the article stated that there were several hundred rooms in this particular complex. And
not quite a Ritz-Carlton, but pretty good, huh?
Well, yeah. And there were, you know, different artifacts that he found. And these are not supposed to be here. He found, you know, vases and urns and copper and gold cups and copper weapons. And there was some slag and charcoal that indicated there was smelting done in this area. And he found enameled pottery and stone.
So pretty advanced people.
It very advanced for this area that had, you know, Indians that were living in the area, living kind of an agrarian, simple lifestyle. This stuff was not supposed to be there. You know, ooparts, they call them out-of-place artifacts. You know, we're not supposed to have these kind of artifacts in the New World. He even found stone tablets with hieroglyphics on them.
Well, what happens to these people, Gary? I mean, it just about every civilization, whether it's the Maya or this Hopi, they disappear. They're just gone. Where do they go?
Well, the people apparently lived there for some time, and for some reason they were driven out. It was a huge complex, as I said. There were Egyptian kind of hieroglyphics, but there was also in one part of the cave, and he said it was several hundred feet long, this one room. He found a carved marble statue of a Buddha in a lotus posture, holding a lotus in each hand. So whether they came from Tibet or whether they came from Egypt, it's hard to say. In another part of the complex, the article calls it the crypt. Kincaid found a number of male mummies that were lying on carved rock shelves.
How old would you say all this was?
Well, you know, I would say at least 1500 BC is my guess, because of the Egyptian artifacts, and I believe that the Egyptians, perhaps with the help of the Phoenicians, sailed around the world and came to the New World and brought these artifacts into the Grand Canyon.
Okay, so with all this, let's talk about Hopi prophecy.
Sure.
What do they say? Is it over for all of us?
No. Yeah, Hopi believe that the fourth world will be ending, okay, but the fifth world will be a much better place, be a world of peace and harmony, and it will be just a new world. But we're going through some very tough times now. The Hopi believe that all these earth changes, they've been prophesied by the elders for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. The Hopi, as I said, have a legacy of prophecy. They're used to receiving these messages from the elders, from the spiritual people. They call them Kikmangwi, and they talk about what will happen in the future, the signs that the fourth world is ending. And there are a lot of different signs. One of the main signs that really keyed the Hopi into sharing their prophecies was called the Gourd of Ashes.
And what is that? And then I want to ask you about the blue star.
Sure. The Gourd of Ashes will fall upon the earth, causing destruction. That's a major prophecy that signals the end of the fourth world.
Sounds like a volcanic eruption.
Well,
isn't
the
it?
Gourd of Ashes was interpreted by the Hopi as the bombs dropping on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And after 1945, the Hopi started to open up. Before that time, the Hopi did not share their prophecies with the rest of the world. But they thought that, well, now's the time to open up and share with the rest of the world, because we're getting close to the end of the fourth world. So the Hopi began to open up and share with different non-Indians that would come to the Hopi land. And they have a number of different prophecies that also signal this end of the cycle.
Well, how close does the Hopi prophecy echo the Book of Revelation?
Well, there are a lot of similarities, I should say, between Revelation and Hopi prophecy, because they talk about earthquakes, they talk about floods, and they talk about tsunamis sweeping over the earth and great battles at the end of this age. So they talk about much of the same thing that that Revelation, the biblical prophecies, do.
Well, and, like you said, they talk about nine different worlds of stages. And we have, what, the seven seals in the Book of Revelation?
Sure. There's one interesting. There are different prophecies given by different elders, so it's kind of hard to keep them straight sometimes. But there's one prophecy or group of prophecies given by a Hopi man named White Feather. And in the summer of 1958, there was a minister named David Young, and he was driving across Arizona. And he picked up this old Hopi man named White Feather, and they kind of sat in the car for a while silently. And Indians are not uncomfortable with silence. That's part of the culture. But eventually White Feather began to open up to David Young, and thought he was worthy of sharing the prophecy with. And he said all his sons were dead, and he was soon to pass into the spirit world. So he wanted to share these nine particular prophecies, nine different prophecies that his grandfathers had taught him. And he was an old man in his 90s. And he started to open up and talk about the different things that would happen at the end of the fourth world. And one of the first ones was there would be white-skinned men come with sticks that struck like thunder.
Rifles.
Right, yeah. And this was, you know, during the settler period when they came in there and with the guns, with the rifles. And also another prophecy was there would be spinning wheels filled with voices. Now, that's kind of a tough one, but if you look at the covered wagons and the way the wheels spin.
How about CDs?
Well, it could be that, too, or it could be the cars that have the whining tires, you know, the voices. And spinning wheels could be a CD. I never thought of that, George. That's good.
Yeah.
And they also have a prophecy. And, you know, these are old prophecies. These are hundreds, if not thousands of years old. And they talked about this beast that looked like a buffalo but had these great long horns.
Well, what is the blue star, Gary?
The blue star is supposed to come at the end of this age. It's called Sakwa Sohu. The blue star will come in the sky. And, you know, there are a lot of different theories about what the blue star is. Some say that the blue star was the Hale-Bopp comet that came in March of 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people were out watching Hale-Bopp when the Phoenix Lights appeared. And, you know, Hopis say that the increased UFO sighting that we're seeing in this age are another sign that the fourth world is ending.
And, well, that could be. Go ahead.
And, you know, there are different interpretations. Comet Holmes a couple years ago. It got a million times brighter in just a few hours. This might be the blue star. Or, you know, I just read about the new comet that's coming. It's called 2012 S1. That's supposed to come on the winter solstice of 2013. And it's supposed to be, you know, as bright as the full moon. And you might be able to see it during the daytime, like Hale-Bopp. So this might be a spectacular comet. That might be the blue star that the Hopi talk about. And when the blue star comes in the sky, there's a blue star kachina that will take off his mask during a kachina dance. So this is kind of unheard of, that a kachina would take off his mask during a dance. It's like a priest taking off his vestments during mass. It's just not simply done. And when the blue star kachina takes off his mask, that will signal the end of the fourth world.
That's the sign. Huh?
That's the sign that the end is very close. And some have said that
when you say the end, that's not all bad.
Well, it's a cycle. It's a cycle that the Hopi believe will turn into the fifth world, a better world. It's not the end of the world. There are a lot of doomsayers, and especially during, you know, 2012, the frenzy of 2012.
Well, that's a matter of fact, Gary, that's what I want to talk with you about in just a moment when we come back. Gary David, our special guest, let's get into his thoughts on the Hopi and the Mayan calendar date, and then, of course, we'll take your phone calls. Next hour on Coast to Coast AM, we're talking about his latest work, Star Shrines and Earthworks of the Desert Southwest, available all over the place. And his website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back. Okay, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Gary David as we talk about the Hopis. When we come back, let's talk about the relationship with the Mayan calendar. Is there any tie-in? That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Gary David. Gary, did the Hopi ever talk about the Mayan calendar, the end date, anything like that?
The Hopi don't deal with dates that much. Um, you know, the Maya were obsessed with time and the calendar, and they have a specific date, December 21st, 2012. But the Hopi are not concerned with particular dates, even though the Hopi, part of the Hopi, did migrate down into Mexico and interacted with the Maya down there before they moved back into Arizona and settled in Arizona. They made a lot of migrations around the continent. They went up into Canada, they went east into Ohio, and some believe that the Hopi built the Serpent Mound. The Snake Clan of the Hopi built the Serpent Mound. But the Hopi also migrated down into the Maya territory. And it is said that the Maya are the people that didn't migrate back up into Hopi land. So, there is definitely a trade network going on through the ages between the Maya and the Hopi. And they did exchange this idea of cyclic time, of time in cycles, of different world ages, that that the Maya and the Aztecs both shared this idea of world ages and a certain age coming to an end and another age following it. But the Hopi see their role very specifically about what they should do during this time. And they see themselves as basically carrying on their ceremonial cycle. It's there are 9 different ceremonies that they perform during the year, and one follows another. The winter solstice ceremony is very important to the Hopi. And, you know, the Hopi on December 21st will be down in the kivas performing the winter solstice ceremony. So they see their role as keeping the world in balance. They have a term called Koyaanisqatsi. They say the world is out of balance. It's totally chaotic. The life is chaotic.
Well, they're right about that.
Yeah, and there are different signs that their prophecies have talked about that are coming true. You know, the prophecies, White Feather's prophecy specifically talked about the sea turning black at the end of the fourth world, and many living things dying in it. And of course, the Gulf oil spill in the summer of 2010. You know, they nailed that one. Pretty accurately.
Well, now tell me a little bit more about whether you think they were given knowledge from above, or maybe they just developed it.
Well, I think the star ancestors came from a particular star in Orion. And my books talk about this particular star. I mentioned it before, Pi 3 Orionis. There's probably exoplanets around this particular star. And I think the Hopi learned from their star ancestors who came to this world and taught them how to live. And, the Kachinas are part of this whole scenario of the spirits that come and help the Hopi survive in the desert. So I think that the star ancestors did come down and help the Hopi survive.
With all the work that you've been doing, Gary, over the past several years, I mean, where do you go next with all this?
I'm going to keep working on this project of star correlations. It's very interesting to me that there are a number of star correlations, not just in Egypt and Arizona, but all over the globe. I've found Orion correlations in Scotland. I've found them in Mexico at Teotihuacan. I've found them up in the UK at Thornborough. And this theme of Orion seems to repeat in a lot of different places, a lot of different sacred sites. Key in on Orion, and I think that is because the star ancestors came down from this particular constellation, Orion, And you know, some of the literature of exoplanetary literature talk about Messau and the grays coming from two particular stars. The small grays are thought to come from Rigel, and the large grays, the tall grays, are thought to come from Betelgeuse. These are two stars in the constellation Orion. So I think the grays definitely had a particular role in the Orion constellation and originated from those places. And the ancient people recognize that these particular these creatures came from this particular constellation. And, you know, in the case of Arizona, they wanted to project this constellation on the Earth specifically, and to see where the star ancestors came from, to recognize the place that the star ancestors originated.
Gary, you mentioned that they were scared of that so-called god, that Messau.
Messau, yeah. He is a spooky, you know, if you look at the...
Did he hurt them?
He didn't hurt them, but, you know, just like Osiris, he's a rather frightening god because he's the god of judgment, the god of fire. He deals with the underworld, so you have to face Messau when you go down to the underworld. And the Hopi believe that when they die, they go back down into the Grand Canyon and down through the Sipapuni to the underworld. So you have to face Messau there. So he's, you know, always in the back of their minds, they're thinking, well, we're going to have to meet Messau sooner or later, you know, when we pass away from this world.
And where did that god go, did they say?
The god is still present among the Hopi people. And
physically or spiritually?
Well, I think it's a physical being, really, that, you know, that is still walking around, you know, kind of like Bigfoot or something, because he has these huge feet, you know. It might be a Bigfoot-type creature that walks around Hopi land, and he's just a frightening character.
Obviously, though, intelligent enough for them to think of it as a god, right?
Yeah, it's a very complex creature, you know. Some say that Messau is the creator himself. Others say that he's the god of death. So he has so many different facets, so many different faces that he presents people through the ages. There have been myths about him that have been translated. There are bilineal texts that talk about the different roles of Messau and the complex relationship he's had with the Hopi people. So it's and like I say, a lot of Hopi won't even talk about Messau. It's a taboo subject.
Tell me about the whirlpool in the sky.
Yeah, the whirlpool in the sky. A lot of the ancient people thought that there was a whirlpool, again, around the feet of Orion, the constellation Orion. And the whirlpool was called the Zalos. And the ancient people called the whirlpool the Zalos. And it's around the star Rigel, and also the star Ypsilon Eridani, which is in the constellation Eridanus, which is named the river which flows from the feet of Orion. And it's kind of interesting that the radio astronomer Frank Drake, who devised
the Drake equation,
Drake's equation. You know, he thought that there's at least 10,000 ET civilizations in our galaxy alone. That
may be an understatement.
Oh yeah, I think so. But Frank Drake was one of the first SETI people that targeted this particular star, Ypsilon Eridani. And by the way, he targeted it at 1420 megahertz on the radio dial. So that's a frequency at which...
Did he target it based on myth?
No, he just picked this because apparently hydrogen resonates at this particular frequency, 1420 megahertz. So that's the way he thought that he could get the attention of any ETs out there. But apparently, you know, this was done in 1960, and he didn't get any results from that. But that was one of the first SETI experiments. It was called Project Ozma, after a character in one of the Wizard of Oz books. But just recently, in 2000, astronomers found a Jupiter-like planet revolving around Epsilon Eridani, and it's the closest exoplanet yet found. So, you know, there's this whirlpool in the sky that the ancients recognized. You know, astronomers are finding that there are exoplanets around this particular particular star, and you know, it might be a sort of stargate or sky portal that that these small gray aliens were coming through. This whirlpool in the sky might be some kind of wormhole or stargate or portal in the sky.
Well, you know, it's amazing, too, that a lot of these stories that we picked up from the ancients seem to be coming true now.
Exactly. The myths are being, you know, scientists are proving that mythology has a place in our culture, and it's not, they're not just quaint stories told by the ancient people. They have meaning, they have depth, they have meaning for our lives, spiritual meaning. Joseph Campbell, of course, was a great mythologist that talked about the deep meaning of mythology, and we should take mythology seriously.
Well, there have been all kinds of theories that abound, from that to you believe the Hopi, of course, came from where? The South Pacific?
Yeah, the Hopi, they have another legend. There's a number of different legends about where the Hopi originated. One of the legends is, as I mentioned before, that they came up through the a giant reed that connected the third world with the fourth, and it came out in the Grand Canyon at this place, the Sipaponi, which you could see on one of the graphics that I have. But another legend says that the Hopi came across the ocean on reed rafts. Okay, they were basically escaping a great flood. The Hopi, the third world of the Hopi was destroyed by a great flood. And the Hopi say that they escaped this by sailing west, sailing to the west coast of America on reed rafts and using the islands as stepping stones, one across the other. In fact, one of the clans of the Hopi is called the Potki, or Water Clan. And it's also called the Houseboat Clan. And they came across the ocean, escaping this great flood. And, you know, some of the people that talk about the continent of Mu, James Churchward, he kind of corroborates this Hopi legend of, you know, going across the ocean, escaping the great flood. You know, this continent of Mu or Lemuria.
Yeah.
It was a continent, 5,000 miles long and 3,000 miles wide. And it supposedly had a population of 64 million. And James Churchward believed that that the Hopi, he called them the cliff dwellers, was the last wave of these people escaping the deluge of Mu, the continent Mu. So, you know, he believed that, these people crossed the ocean on reed rafts and made it to Arizona and New Mexico. And he even said that the symbols of Mu and the symbols of the Pueblo people were very much the same. He visited Arizona and New Mexico in the early 1930s, and he thought that the symbols were identical, and the symbols written on the rocks, carved in the rocks, were just like the symbols of Mu.
Have the Hopis Has the story been consistent throughout the years?
I think the stories are amazingly consistent, even though there are a lot of different prophecies that different elders have put forth through the years and have come to us just recently, since the mid-20th century. I think that they are very stable people. Their myths are very stable. They're consistent, and their ceremonies, their rituals are basically meant to keep the world in balance, because they believe that if they stop doing their ceremonies, the sacred ceremonies, 9 of them throughout the year, that the world will be out of balance. They believe that there are they call them warrior twins, that are stationed one at each pole. And if the Hopi stop doing their ceremonies, they believe that the world will be out of balance and we'll have a pole shift. And so the Hopis' role in this world is to keep their ceremonies going. The Hopi are a very conservative people. I'm not talking politically, but just spiritually conservative. And they try to keep the ceremonies positive and consistent with what's gone on before. But the Hopi believe that if they cease to do their ceremonies, then the whole world will be out of balance and we'll probably have a pole shift, because these warrior twins will leave their station and the world will not, the axis of the earth will not rotate properly.
Are they concerned at all about our future?
The Hopi are very concerned, and that's why they put so much energy into making these ceremonies, doing these ceremonies in the proper way. And it's getting tougher and tougher. I have a Hopi friend that said, I foresee the whole ceremonial cycle ending within my lifetime. And he's about 50 years old. And he thinks that, the fourth world will end and we'll go into the fifth world. But the Hopi are valiantly trying to keep their ceremonies alive. If you go up to the Hopi mesas, you can watch the Kachina dances, and they take special care in trying to make every ceremony just the way it should be and not vary from the main theme. They're trying to keep the old ceremonies and the traditional ways alive. And it's getting tougher and tougher, George, because, the kids have to go off and make a living in the cities. The children are not learning the Hopi language the way they used to. They're not hearing the stories. They're not learning the rituals.
They're probably not interested. They want to play video games.
Yeah.
Like every kid, right?
It's a very kind of a hard time for a lot of reservations are like this, of course. Most reservations, you have this struggle between the traditional ways and the people who just want to reject the tradition and go into the 20th century. And, you go up to Hopi land and you can see mobile homes with satellite dishes and so forth. And then in the next village, you can see stone adobe houses with no electricity and so forth. So it's a real almost a schizoid kind of existence now.
When we come back, I want to talk with you about the Hopi prophecy rock, Gary, what that all means. And, of course, we'll take phone calls in the final hour with you. Gary David, our special guest, we're talking about his latest work, Star Shrines and Earthworks of the Desert Southwest, his views on the Hopi and the Hopi prophecy. We shall be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.